Hello, podcasters. What a day to listen to the podcast. We start with Chernobyl and how that relates to healthcare here in America and Joe Biden. Don't want to miss it. Don't want to miss John Douglas. If you saw the Netflix show Mindhunter, this is the Mindhunter. This is the guy who is talking to all the serial killers for the FBI. He is fascinating, just fascinating. Also, Dave Rubin is on. He's just broken through the million mark on YouTube, and he talks about how YouTube is trying to stop him. And
on that front, real quick, Glenn, I mean, you know, here's a situation where people are getting taken down off of YouTube. They're being deplatformed from all of these sites. This is why, essentially, I mean, really, you have reason at the beginning that you created the Blaze, and now it's a created part of this Blaze Media situation, which is fantastic. BlazeTV.com/Glenn is the place to go to subscribe. Help conservatives get their voice out. People who care about free speech. BlazeTV.com/Glenn. Use the promo code Glenn.
Okay, and Blake Harris, he's the author of The History of the Future. He came in today on the podcast with some emails that he has received from journalists. He exposed Mark Zuckerberg, in a way, kind of against his will. He was a fan of Mark Zuckerberg, on a massive, massive scandal where Mark forced an executive of Oculus to issue a statement that he was not for Donald Trump, even though he was. It's illegal. It's crazy. And then Facebook fired him. That story is in the book, The History of the Future, but he brought in some responses from journalists on why they were okay with getting the story so wrong. Don't miss a second of today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Patriot Mobile is a phone service that will give you all of the great coverage that you want. They're just not going to take the money from you and then invest that in causes that you don't believe in, like Planned Parenthood. Patriot Mobile actually is going to let you invest your money into the causes that you believe in. But most of these cell companies, They give all kinds of money to crazy, crazy causes that you work hard against.
It's true. Why do that? You can go with Patriot Mobile. They were created to solve that problem. They're the only conservative cell phone company in America. Go to patriotmobile.com/blaze. Get started today. When you use the offer code Blaze, they're going to waive the activation fee for up to two lines. Patriotmobile.com/blaze or 1-800-A-PATRIOT is the place to go.
Boy, we've got a great show for you today. We have John Douglas is going to be on with us. You may not know his name, but if you read the New York Times bestseller or saw, what is it? I think a Netflix show, Mindhunter. This is the guy who has interviewed David Berkowitz, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Charles Manson, Lynette Fromm, Edmund Kemper, James Earl Ray, Sirhan Sirhan, Richard Speck. I mean, all of them. He's the guy who started the behavioral science at the FBI. It's going to be a fascinating interview. Also, Dave Rubin is going to be joining us today, and Blake J. Harris, more on Facebook and his book, The History of the Future, coming up. But I want to start with, can we play the audio of Joe Biden where he is? He is talking compassionately here about how America must now provide health care for people who are here illegally.
Look, I think that anyone who is in a situation where they're in need of health care, regardless of whether they're documented or undocumented, we have an obligation to see that they're cared for. That's why I think we need more clinics around the country. And this idea that undocumented, and by the way, a significant portion of undocumented folks in this country are there because they've overstayed their visas. It's not people breaking down gates coming across the border.
Okay, stop. Either way, it doesn't matter. Here's the thing. If you want socialized medicine, then you must have a secure border. We cannot do both You want open borders? Great. Private medicine. But you cannot open the borders and say, anybody who's sick, come to America. Because then we're healing the world and we will not have the resources to heal anybody in a very short period of time. That's just math. And I know that math doesn't really work for socialists right now. But in the end, the gods of the copybook headings will teach us that 2 and 2 do indeed always equal 4.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is amazing. You have a society that is trying to do both, right? I mean, even libertarians, and there are some libertarians who kind of, not open borders, but argue for much, you know.
Many libertarians are open borders.
Some of them might even say they're open borders. But the reason is, well, we don't have to support them. We don't have to have these giant programs. We don't want them.
Correct.
So if you don't have socialist medicine, if you don't have free health care for everybody, if you don't have a requirement to treat every person at a hospital that needs to be treated.
Or educate every kid that comes in.
Right. Financially, it's not a problem. Now, there's other reasons why you might not want to do that, but financially, it doesn't become as big a problem because, well, I mean, look, you're not giving away all this money.
Right.
There's still employment and concerns and everything else. Mm-hmm. But this is the way it goes every single time. And you have to understand, and I don't think many of the younger, millennials and younger who are suddenly embracing socialism realize what underlies that. What underlies all of socialism is your dedication to the state. It's the state as your God. And that is really where this ends up. You can sit back and say, well, I want this program and I want this program. But once things start going wrong, the socialist government that you've given all this power to has no other option but to protect itself at all costs. And that dedication winds up killing 100 million people in a century or so, right? We've seen this before. There's a great new series on HBO called Chernobyl. Have you seen this yet?
I haven't. I've seen the ads for it, but I will tell you, this is a great way, assuming that it's good. I know you've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So assuming that it is good, this is a great way to teach our kids who did not live through the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
teach our kids and our grandkids exactly what it's like to live in a socialist country.
Yeah.
Remember, it's not really communists. You know, the communists, oh, they didn't do communism right. No, that's right. That's why it was the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
Soviet socialist states. Okay. So it was not communism because that's the higher law. It was socialist. And so when you see what a real socialist state was, and Chernobyl is a great example of what happens.
And it's also a great example of what happens to the regular people, because the regular people who are in the society, they might not be, socialist ideologues, right? They're people who are just trying to make a living, and they're living under what is, I believe, a terrible system. And many of the people in the Soviet Union during Chernobyl were heroes. The people who were working there, the people who came in to try to stop it.
Firefighters.
I mean, and they talk about this and they show it in great detail of what they went through and what they were asked to do. But let me give you this part. This is amazing. So to set the scene, Chernobyl's happened, the nuclear meltdown in the Soviet Union, Ukraine. And they are talking about what do we do? Now, they have not come to the point where they realized how bad it was or had admitted to themselves how bad it was. And they're just starting to have those first conversations back and forth about, most people are saying, oh, it's a fire and it's mostly out. And the other side's saying, look, I think we should evacuate the town. I mean, this looks a lot worse than we thought it was, and we should get the people out of the town. And so there's the two sides of this arguing back and forth at this table as they're planning for what happens to the people in the community. And as this is all going on, an old guy, an old socialist, an old school guy, taps his cane on the floor and silences the room and gives this speech. It's amazing. Listen to this.
I wonder how many of you know the name of this place. We will call it Chernobyl, of course. What is its real name?
The Vladimir I. Lenin Nuclear Power Station.
Exactly. Vladimir I. Lenin. and how proud he would be of you all tonight. Especially you, young man, and the passion you have for the people. For is that not the sole purpose of the apparatus of the state? Sometimes we forget. Sometimes we fall prey to fear. That our faith in Soviet socialism will always be rewarded. Now, the state tells us the situation here is not dangerous. Have faith, comrades. The state tells us it wants to prevent a panic. Listen well. It's true. When the people see the police, they will be afraid. But it is my experience that when the people ask questions that are not in their own best interest, they should simply be told to keep their minds on their labor and leave matters of the state to the state. We seal off the city. No one leaves. And cut the phone lines. Contain the spread of misinformation. That is how we keep the people from undermining the fruits of their own labor. Yes, comrades. We will all be rewarded for what we do here tonight. This is our moment to shine.
That is...
Wow.
Amazing. They don't let the people undermine their fruits of their own labor when they ask questions that are not in their best interests.
So John Huntsman was a friend of mine, John Huntsman Sr.
Yeah.
And we talked because he was one of the first guys in the former Soviet Union. And, you know, the idea was capitalists can go in and help heal the country. So he bought Aeroflot Airlines. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he bought, when the Soviet Union collapsed, these were all state-run things.
And they sold them off.
And they sold them off. So he went in and he thought, I'll buy Aeroflot so the planes can still fly. He bought Aeroflot. He sold it so quickly because when he bought it, little did he know how bad things were. They literally would lose planes full of passengers, plow it into a mountain. And when the families would be waiting at the gate, waiting for their family, that plane to arrive, they would say it's late. And then they would find out that, you know, it had crashed the heads of it. And they would say the heads of Aeroflot would just tell the gate people never took off. This never took off. This plane didn't exist. And so the people who were standing at the gate went, I just talked to my aunt or my husband. He was getting on to that plane. Nope, that plane never took off. I don't know where your husband is. And they just had to go back to their home and concentrate on their labor.
Yeah. They couldn't ask questions.
Couldn't ask questions. That is the real problem of socialism. Is there's no police to run to. When a corporation, that would never happen in America. Can you imagine a plane just plows into a mountain and American Airlines would say, nah, that plane never took off. It wouldn't happen.
Yeah, no.
It wouldn't happen. But if the state controls the communication, the airlines, and absolutely everything else, who are you going to run to? Your husband dies in a plane crash. Your husband is at Chernobyl and it's a massive meltdown. Nobody gets sued. No, nobody investigates because the police are part of it. And socialists don't understand that. Somehow or another, they just, and it comes from this progressive idea that man can progress. Well, yes, man can progress, but each man must progress on his own. And so there are certain things that are naturally born into all of us.
Yeah.
And a willingness to be corrupt if you're in charge. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah, a friend of mine works with a bunch of millennials, and they're having some conversation about some mandatory program that generally speaking would be a good idea, but should it be mandatory? And none of them could see any negative. These aren't left wingers either. Couldn't see any negative in the government forcing these people to participate in it. And it's fascinating because that is all they could see was the common good. Well, what you just heard, that speech is the end of the common good. That's where it gets to. Remember, he's not doing this because he wants to kill people.
Right.
He's doing this because he wants to protect Soviet socialism, which is for the common good. And I have a proposal here. You know when you go to like a YouTube and you click play in a video and it says you have to wait 15 seconds before you see the video?
Mm-hmm.
I think when you go to a voting booth and you try to vote for Bernie Sanders, you should have to wait and watch that entire video before the vote goes through. Just you should just be able to see what you're voting for.
Are you sure?
Are you sure?
Really?
You're passing
you
this vote? Are you sure?
Okay.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and I want to tell you about something that you should either end your day with or start your morning with, and that is The News and Why It Matters. If you like this show, you're going to love The News and Why It Matters. It's a bunch of us that all get together at the end of the day and just talk about the stories that matter to you and your life. The News and Why It Matters. Look for it now wherever you download your favorite podcast. Pat Gray joins us now from Pat Gray Unleashed, the podcast that is sweeping America.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's talking about it.
Everybody's talking about it.
I mean, it's crazy. It's a little embarrassing.
And what do you have?
Calm down, everybody.
And what do you have? What do you have for us today?
I have a stat that I think you're going to love on immigration. Well, illegal immigration.
I'm going to love it.
I think you're going to love this.
Okay.
From the entire populations of Guatemala and Honduras, 1% of the total population of each of those countries has crossed the U.S. border. Wow. But you're thinking, okay, what, since 1975, 1980? Since last September. You know, how old were you last September? I was six. And so, I mean,
1% of the population
of two pretty significant countries have illegally entered our country in the last 9 months. 9 months!
Wow. But this is definitely not
an
invasion. It's not a crisis and not an invasion.
Right.
Can you imagine if 1% of Iran or Al-Qaeda, 1% of Al-Qaeda came across and just was in 9 months in America, would we say there's a problem?
I mean,
of course we would.
I would love to know what percentage must come across the border illegally from those two countries or any other countries?
75%.
75%?
Yeah,
and then they'd get alarmed?
Then I'd start to get worried.
See,
I'd put in a chain link fence at that point.
Hang on just a second.
I mean, you can look at it as if, well, it's not 100%, right?
Right.
We didn't empty out both those countries. There's still some people to come.
Make the suggestion? May I make the suggestion that let's slow down on this. Let's think about this for a minute.
Okay.
Because there's no place for conservatives to go right now. Like, I'd love to live in California. I'll never live in California. It's crazy. So why don't we look at Honduras and say, okay, I tell you what, you guys sneak across the border and you come in here. And when you get to about 99%, just alert us. And then I'm going to go down to Honduras, buy the entire country, and we will live as conservatives and free men.
You know, that's kind of appealing, actually.
It is.
It's kind of
appealing.
We got
oceanfront property.
We'll start over.
Yeah.
And just use the Constitution, and we'll live by that. You guys, go ahead and
go ahead.
Whatever you
Have
want
a good time.
There.
Have a good time.
It's nuts. The Democrats love to talk about sustainability. That's not sustainable. Is it sustainable that every 9 months, another 1% from those
two countries,
American countries or any countries, continue to flood into the United States? That's sustainable?
Can you imagine?
You know it's not.
1% of Canada. 1% of Canada crossed our border.
They'd be pissed about it.
Who'd be pissed?
The left?
Oh, yeah. Well, they'd be pissed because...
They'd be bringing their back bacon and their and curling and all their...
They would not like that at the Olympics.
No, they wouldn't. No, they wouldn't.
But I would be just as upset if it was Canada.
I would, too.
Doesn't matter.
Absolutely. Doesn't matter if it's the UK or Canada, Norway. I don't care. It's unsustainable. We just can't do it. It's...
Well, you heard Joe Biden yesterday talk about health care, right?
Yeah.
Where he said, we have to provide health care. We have to provide
health care. It's our obligation.
So now we are providing health care for 1% of the population of those two countries. In 9 months, we're taking on 1% of two different countries, and we're going to be providing their health care. How? How is that sustainable?
How and how? Who pays for it?
Who pays for it?
Of course we do.
Right. We got to pay for the education. We have to pay for the health care. We have to pay for the living, you know, as if we capture them. We have to house them.
You lie!
That usually works against that point, I've noticed, over the past few years. If you just yell, you lie.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't anymore
because
they're just admitting it now.
Yeah, they're just admitting it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think about that all the time when you predicted years ago. They're just going to start admitting all this stuff. And they have. And they are. And they're just naked Marxists now.
Because I told you at the time, remember what I said, they want to.
Oh, they do.
They're dying to tell you. They are so confident that socialism is the thing. They're dying to tell you.
And it's in these moments you need to remember what the truth is. Because, it wasn't that different in the mid-90s. When Bill Clinton was saying the era of big government is over, they didn't believe anything differently then. They just weren't telling you.
Yeah, they were faking it.
They just believed that at that point, the best way to advance it was to say the era of big government was over. And now they believe the opposite. They think they can come out and admit it. And you're right, they're dying to do it.
And here's the thing. We were conspiracy theorists for saying that that's what they wanted to do.
9 years ago, we were conspiracy theorists.
Now they're coming out and saying it, and... When you point it out, nobody says you're a conspiracy theorist anymore. They're like, yeah. You're like, wait,
yeah,
what?
Yeah, I am a socialist. Yeah, I'm
wait
communist.
A minute.
What? That's a better system.
Yeah. And then there are those people who I think the vast majority of the voting Democrats
are different than Washington Democrats.
Yes, big time. And I think that the vast majority of the voting Democrats... and you see this as evidenced by, Joe Biden being up 32 to 40 points ahead of any of the other competitors.
Yeah.
There is this desire. There is this starving for anything other than socialist in the Democratic Party. And they are willing to accept Joe Biden not being a socialist. But he'll give you the same stuff. He's going to give you exactly the same stuff. You can't, he wrapped it yesterday in compassion. Compassion, yes, but if you're in a lifeboat, I'm sorry, but when the lifeboat is full, you must steer the lifeboat away from the people who are flailing. And I'm sorry, but we will all die.
And when that happens, who then can we help? The answer is no one.
No one. When the lifeboat has been capsized or sunk,
everybody drowns.
Correct. You have to balance compassion with reason.
Yeah.
And when it comes to this situation, we are not able. We're the richest country in the world. No, we're not. We're the biggest debtor in the history of the world. We have $23 trillion. $23 trillion. By the way, do you know how much money we have spent on poverty since the Great Society speech from LBJ?
Was it 20 trillion?
$22 trillion.
Yeah.
So everything that we've done, and the poverty numbers have not changed.
No.
Everything that we have done, we are now in debt $22 or $23 trillion. We spend about $20 or $22 trillion trying to fix poverty. None of this is working.
And
those are all socialist programs, and none of them are working.
It was 14% poverty rate, I think, in 1965. It's 14% today. After $22 or $23 trillion.
It's crazy.
Same with the war on drugs. I mean, all these wars that we're fighting against...
Because it doesn't work
that way.
It doesn't work that way. You know? It's like telling somebody who's depressed, you know, just cheer up. It doesn't work.
By the way, the border, if you would like to talk about real compassion, Mercury One is implementing child rescue systems at the border right now in Texas and New Mexico. We got this charge. We were asked by churches because these churches, another delivery is coming today to some of these churches. 2,000 people just dumped on their doorstep today.
Wow.
Okay. And the problem is these churches are...
And yesterday, didn't we say it was 1,000 a day yesterday? And now it's 2,000?
It's 2,000 today.
At least today.
Today. Wow. So Operation Underground Rescue got a phone call from one of these churches on the border and said, you got to help us. You have to train our people because we know we are handing these kids over to sex traffickers, but we can't do anything about it.
The churches admitted that?
Yeah, they said we can't do anything about it.
They have to.
You have to. So what
do we do? The Democrats have put them in that position.
Right. So we are sitting here providing training so the churches can identify the smugglers and we will assist the government busting up these rings. But we really need your help. Mercury One, the idea was to be a catalyst to restore the human spirit when it's broken. And if our spirit of Americans on the border isn't broken, I don't know what is. These people have been abandoned. American citizens and towns and churches have been abandoned by our federal government. Let's help these towns out on the border. All you have to do is just go to mercuryone.org and donate $5 a month, whatever you can do. mercuryone.org, but please give, or you can call 972-499-4747. More on that later. Pat, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Hey, it's Glenn. And if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
John Douglas, the original Mind Hunter, is on with us now. Hello, John. How are you, sir?
Very well, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to talk to you. I remember what you went through when you first started talking to people, because I remember my grandfather saying, these guys are just talking to them. They're going to make excuses. I don't care what happened to them in their life. They did the crime, and that was the prevalent theory when you started interviewing these mass murderers.
Correct. At the FBI, very, very much what's happening on the series, the Mindhunter series on Netflix, the question was, why am I doing this? What are you doing? And you shouldn't be going into the prisons doing these interviews. Well, at the time I was 32 years old. I came back to Quantico after working 7 years in the field. I was a very young agent when I was recruited. I just got out of the military, had 4 years of the military, a couple advanced degrees, and came back. And with sitting back in the classroom now, I had to audit the senior instructors. And these senior instructors just didn't have their facts right. And how do I know that? Because there were police officers in the classroom that were challenging the instructors. And they say, hey, look, you know, I worked the Manson case. You got your facts all screwed up. So here I am now, 32 years old, and I got to get up in front of these senior investigators from throughout the world and FBI agents, you know, at some point. And what can I do to accelerate my learning? So in the old days, we had what we call road schools. You go out and maybe teaching in San Diego, then later on Boise, Idaho. And, you know, let's go into these prisons. I asked my partner. I said, let's go. Let's see if Manson will talk to us. Let's see if David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, or Sirhan, and thought it was a crazy idea, but went into the prisons just unannounced, which was kind of good. When you're an agent, you just show your creds, you can go in, and you don't have to tell anybody why you want to speak to these people. And to our surprise, they were very, 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 very forthcoming, very, very interested in speaking with me. But we made mistakes early on in the when we first started doing the interviews. We'd go in there with notes, go in there with a tape recorder, and that was a turnoff for them. Why? Because they're paranoid individuals, and they should be paranoid. They're incarcerated with a lot of other violent offenders. They don't trust corrections. They're certainly not going to trust the FBI. So what I began to do as we went along, and we teamed up with Dr. Ann Burgess, Boston College, and we developed a computerized instrument for interviews, which I would never fill out during the interview process. It would be before and after the interview. And then started to, document this material and began to get some really fantastic information from them regarding victim selection, pre-offense behavior, post-offense behavior. Then I started thinking, what can I do creatively to create a situation where I may cause David Berkowitz, for example, to go to the gravesite of his victims, or to inject himself into the police investigation. Well, the Bureau stood afar. They were really against this. You know, what the hell are you doing? This kind of work. And they were really the last ones to embrace my own agency. They were waiting for me, I think, to screw up, and then they'd send me to Butte, Montana, to work cattle rustling cases or
right.
something like that. So they were the last ones to embrace it. And then when I got really some international publicity, and I was doing so many cases, but then when I hit the Atlanta child killings was very controversial. I was censured by the Bureau when I publicly said the killer would be a black offender, would not be white in that particular case. And historically, we had a lot of white serial killers leading up to that time. And when they finally arrested Wayne B. Williams in the case, then I got involved in cross-examination strategies, coaching the prosecutor on how to go after him on the stand. And again, I was very, 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 very young. But now, as this young agent, and when I would now get in front of a group, senior agents, you're like the old show E.F. Hutton. When E.F. Hutton speaks, everyone listens.
Yeah.
So they started listening. But along the way, it's stressful, man. It's stressful.
John, let me ask you this on the stress part of it. First of all, I don't want to give any spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen the series on Netflix. But is that last episode, did that at all anything like that? Did you go through that?
Well, it's actually worse. It's worse than the episode.
Oh my gosh!
Because that particular way that didn't happen like that. But I was training in New York City in 1983, and it was around October, November. And while on stage training several hundred police from Nassau County, Suffolk, all around Manhattan, I just came back on the Yorkshire Ripper case. I have to go up to Alaska where a guy is hunting down women. He's abducting women, stripping them down naked as he takes them to his airplane, flies them up into the wilderness and hunts them down.
Oh,
and then there's the Green River killer in Seattle, Washington.
Yeah.
So I had this anxiety attack while on stage, and I know my material so well that my mouth is talking, but my brain is elsewhere. And I feel like I'm having a heart attack. I'm perspiring. I'm saying to myself, I'm saying, Douglas, man, you got to regroup. You got to come out of this. Refocus, focus. And so I got through it. I don't think no one ever said anything. No one ever detected it. But by the time I got back to Quantico, I felt at 38 years of age, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm going to have cancer. Something's going to happen to me. So I took out all this income protection insurance. And then it's now time to go out on the Green River murder case in Seattle, Washington. I have tremendous headaches. I have to train two younger agents now assigned to my program. And the long and short out there, what happened was, is before I went to the task force, come back to my hotel room, tell the agents I feel like I'm getting a flu. And that night I collapsed in my hotel room floor. they kick down the door 3 days later because they have a do not disturb sign on the door, and they find me in a frog-like position. My brain had split in the right temporal lobe from 107-degree body temperature. My heartbeat's 220, and I'm in a coma. And I'll remain in a coma for a week and come out of the coma paralyzed all along the left side, can't speak. Before I came out of the coma, they were planning, I'm a veteran, they were planning to bury me at the veteran cemetery. And the doctors later on, when I came back, they flew me back after a month in the hospital back to where I live in Virginia, went to various doctors, went to psychologists, and the psychologist tested me, and they said, John, I said, man, well, first you have viral encephalitis brought on, your immune system is so low, you came very close to dying, plus you had complications of blood clots that nearly killed you, and he says, but you were really suffering this post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the things we see and our veterans coming back, but you're experiencing the same kind of thing here, dealing with death and violence and dealing with the victims of these violent crimes that break your heart when you have to deal with them, or when a victim's mother tells you, John, you have to tell me how my daughter was killed.
Oh my gosh.
Did my daughter fight? And, you know, on and on. And it really is, it was emotionally exhausting.
So, John, did you, because in watching you and in reading these books that you've written, you, at least I am, I think the toll on you on sitting, you know, and intentionally making them feel superior to you by adjusting the chair so they're higher than you are and doing all these things, yeah, and befriending them, it just seems like there is you're paying a price in your soul to be able to get this information.
Well, yeah, I give you an example. I interviewed Richard Speck, who killed 7 nurses in the Chicago area, and he was extremely violent. They were holding him in a cage, and they wanted me to show me his cell first and his pornography in his cell. But meanwhile, he's screaming and yelling like crazy. And when I finally got back in his cage with him, I was with his counselor. I decided to totally ignore him and turn my back to him. And I had a conversation with his counselor. And I used street language in talking to his counselor about the crimes that he committed, you know, kind of filthy kind of language, but the kind of language that, you know, Richard Speck can identify with. And I said something to the effect that, you know, to his counselor, I said, I don't know what this guy eats for breakfast, but man, I said, he raped these 7, you know, 7 women. I just don't understand it. I knew he didn't do that. So he chimes in behind me, and he's sitting up on top of Cardenza. I'm 6'2", and he's 6'2" as well, but he still wants to dominate, you know, over me, and you let him do it. And he says, I didn't, and using street terms, what he did to those girls. And I said, I know. I said, it was just the one on the couch. And he says, you're crazy, man. You ought to be in here, you're with us. I mean, you're just like us. And I'm really not just like him, but I have to show this false sense of empathy. And I'd be lying to you, Glenn, if I tell you at the end of the day, when I have to come back to my own family and at the time, and then the young children, you know, that have and that you may have flashbacks. You may even be in bed with your wife one night, and you're thinking that some amorous type of thing you may want to be doing, but now you're thinking about some horrific case that you're working on, and it's really it's dangerous to your health.
All right, I want to take a.
I assume you don't tell her that on date night.
Yeah,
you know, like, oh, honey, yeah, you know what I'm thinking about right now.
John, I'm going to take a quick break for about a minute, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation. But I just have to thank you for what you've endured as a human being for all of our sakes. You know, you put up with both sides, the law and the devil, and took a lot of grief, and thank you for standing and doing that.
Well, thank you.
Back in just one more minute.
Fascinating. Wow.
John Douglas, the killer across the table. He is the original Mindhunter. That if you've seen the Netflix show, this is the guy.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Dave Rubin. How are you, sir?
Glenn, it's good to be with you.
Where are you? Like the North Pole? This is the worst phone connection I've heard since my grandmother.
Are we on a bad connection here? I'm in my backyard at the moment because LA AT&T service is hit or miss.
Yeah, well, wow, it's bad.
Let me see if I can shift into.
No, it's fine. It just sounds like you're using an old timey phone and a lot of hiss. It's like I've got a person to person, coast to coast call for you, Mr. Beck.
Well, Glenn, I have to go on the assumption that, you know, I've been dealing with these problems with YouTube, that it must be the phone company coming after me, too.
That's right. Congratulations on 1 million subscribers on YouTube. And I know you have taken some pretty big risks recently to stand up for your principles. And putting your eggs in the YouTube basket is really kind of a frightening thing. And it is paying off for you in some regard. I know that they demonetize you. If you have anybody that is slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, I know they flag you immediately.
Well, it's pretty crazy what they're doing. And, you know, this is a really, really interesting debate that we've discussed a little bit before, where it's starting to push my libertarian side, which is the core of what I am. It's pushing my libertarian side to its limits because, look, these are private companies, and in my estimation, they can do what they want to do. Nobody's forcing me to be on YouTube. I'm voluntarily using their service. They provide when they're doing it right, and people are getting your videos and they're staying subscribed and all those things. They're providing an incredible service and all of those things. So I say that primarily, but the next part is, have these tech companies become so awesomely powerful that we actually can't even grapple with how much information they control, how much power they have, the amount of connections that they have with the government at this point. These are all things that we have to think about. And, you know, there is a seemingly really big push I'm seeing on the right now from conservatives to ask for government intervention.
Don't.
The big tech.
Bad idea.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
Well, so look, I get why in the short term people think this will be good, because it does seem that conservatives are getting banned more. But you have to always take, you know, a couple steps down the road with these things. And the point is, well, if you hand over the power to the government, I mean, first off, the idea that the government could run tech companies or regulate tech companies. I mean, when was the last time you were on a government website? It looks like AOL in 1994. So that's just like the easy version of it. But the real issue, of course, is that, so let's say you hand over the power to the government to regulate or to be in charge of these tech companies or break them up or whatever it is. Well, the government now, a Trump, you know, conservative presidency might be friendly to conservatives right now. But what happens if the Democratic Socialists get in power and now they've got the tech companies? We know they have the tech companies, and now they've got the government too. I mean, how quickly do you think they'll be banning all of the people that they deem to be, you know, Nazis and white supremacists and the rest of it? So that's where, you know, I know you know this, but that, of course, is where you really have to be leery of using power until the absolute last second.
First of all, you know, regulation, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg comes out and is begging for regulation,
yep.
you know, it's yep. in his best interest at Facebook to have regulation. And the reason why is because they will come to those people and those companies and say, how do we regulate? And they will write the laws which will take all competition and crush any possible contender to their throne. On top of that, if we get them and we go to them and say, how do we regulate you? And they get their regulation, it will not only crush all competition, but on top of it, it will then make the Bill of Rights absolutely worthless, because these are companies that are private, and so they do have a right. But if they're the backbone, and because of regulation, that's really all our choice, they can ban any voice and you have nowhere to go, because the Bill of Rights does not apply to them. It will apply to the government.
So this is the catch-22, and I think for people like us that put liberty before everything else, I think this is the tricky spot that we're in. Because look, you know, Glenn, you've built an incredible company using digital properties, right? Like, I'm on YouTube. We do podcasts and all sorts of things. Now, the simple truth is, you probably have some extra protections because of the way I think you have a technology arm of the Blaze, so some of your stuff
yes.
is proprietary. But which is actually probably the way all creators should be going ultimately, and I've been researching a little bit into that. But the point is that right this moment, as we're talking, technically there's nothing that I can do to stop YouTube from just shutting me off and iTunes kicking me out and the rest of it.
Correct.
And it's like that is a truly, truly awesome power that they have, especially as we know that all of this seems to be getting ramped up to 2020. So it's putting all of us, especially the liberty-minded folks, in a really weird position. And what I'm afraid of is I'm seeing too many conservatives, you know, chomp at the bit here and say, you know, regulate.
It's the wrong way
and
to go.
It will just be used together. Now, that being said, you know, creating the competition. So for people like us that believe in competition, right? We believe in human ingenuity. We believe we can solve problems. And I would always rather the free market solving. I mean, there's still a major issue here, which is that the amount of money and resources to solve these problems is so massive. And, you know, there's blockchain technologies and all sorts of interesting things that are still sort of years away from being mass adopted. So we're just at a unique point. And, you know, hopefully those of us that are doing good work and trying to get some truth out there, you know, hopefully it's not being turned against us just yet. But you just don't know. You really don't.
Dave, I want to make a pitch for somebody. There is a guy who wrote the book, The History of the Future. His name is Blake Harris. Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm. You know, his name has come across every now and again. I get messages suddenly, and a few people have messaged me about him.
You need to have him on. I've had him on several times, and the story that he tells, he's just like you. I mean, he was a liberal, and now he's kind of like, wait a minute. That's not what I bought into. I'm on the wrong side. And he's much more of a classic liberal, very, very freedom minded, but he has the inside scoop of what's happening with Zuckerberg and Facebook. He has evidence of laws being, broken by Mark Zuckerberg himself. It's incredible. And no one in the media is giving him any attention. And, you know, his books, you know, one of his first book is being made into, was made into a movie and now a TV show.
And Seth Rogen is in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
interesting. You know, yeah, I do know who he is. He's the guy that wrote the book about Oculus and some of the internal documents that were going around.
Yes.
Yeah. I will talk to him for sure. And it's super interesting. And, you know, that actually brings up a good point. Something that I was sort of tweeting about this morning is that the other thing that we're seeing right now, you know, in an age of fake news, it's not just sort of the nonsense that the media puts out that's fake news and the manipulation and, you know, quotes where they literally take out the word not at the beginning of the sentence or any of that stuff. It's also what they refuse to report on. So, for example, this week, you know, I'm sure you talked about it on your show, but Brian Sims, the state rep in Pennsylvania, who was harassing those little girls outside of the abortion clinic, it's like CNN did not even touch that story. And that is a type of fake news that we need to be aware of. You know, that the Muslim school in Philadelphia where they were literally training jihadists.
Yes.
Kids as jihadists.
Yes.
Also in Philadelphia. It's like that wasn't touched. And it's like if you took the reverse of any of these where this was a Christian school or it was a Christian man harassing somebody else or a Republican or a conservative doing any of these things, if you flip the immutable characteristics on these things, the media would be in an outrage. So we need to really recalibrate how we're looking at media as a whole.
It's why
and that's, of course, directly related to all the stuff we're talking about with the tech companies.
It's honestly why we have to talk to one another, because we just assume that the Democrats that we might know, and I'm not talking about the activists, I'm talking about just the average Democrat that we know. We think that they know these stories. And I did this with Riaz Patel, who is a guy who is very liberal. And after the election, I brought him in and I said, let me show you these stories. I just picked like 10 or 15 stories. This is why we were so upset at Barack Obama. And I gave him the stories, and I think about 8 out of those 10 stories, and he's a well-informed guy. He had never heard of. He was like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. And it was because of the editing of the truth.
Yeah, and this is the huge problem with, you know, look, we're all walking around with iPhones. We have access to information in an absolutely unprecedented way, a way that I think 20 years from now, there will be many, many studies written on how this changed human mind and human communication and all of these things. But, you know, there is a risk here in that, you know, 20 years ago when we had ABC, you know, CBS, NBC, you basically got the same stories out of the three networks. Cable news then erupted and you got a little bit of a widening of that. And now we live in a time where there's basically no safeguards whatsoever. Now, I generally think that's a good thing. But the problem is that we're all catering it to ourselves. And then, yes, the good, because I believe, and I know you do too, there are still good liberals out there. But they are having the wool pulled over their eyes and they don't hear these stories. And then, you know, then they see us, you know, sort of ranting and raving about things and they go, you know, they're just nuts. You know, they're aiming the wrong way. And it's like, this is why what I've always said is if the media would just do a decent job, mm-hmm. they don't have to do a great job. They don't even have to do a good job. Truly, I mean this. If they would just be doing a decent job so that I could wake up every morning and look at Twitter and not realize that CNN either misquoted several people or, you know, absolutely ignored a story or whatever it is. If they would just not do that, then the bunch of us that are on the outside of this, that are doing this in a YouTube space or in a podcast space, we wouldn't have as much ammo. And I would actually prefer that. I would find something else to do with my life. I wouldn't mind moving to a farm one day, you know?
Yeah, me too. Me too. Dave, congratulations. Thank you so much. We'll talk again.
This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Blake J. Harris on with us now. He is the author of the book, The History of the Future. And welcome to it. How are you?
I am great. And in part, perhaps largely in part, because of you guys and what you did for me to help get the word out about the book a few weeks ago. It really, it's career changing and therefore life changing because my life is my career.
Yeah, that's nice of you to say, but you deserve it. The book is fantastic. And if we lived in a fair world, it would have been reviewed and would have been everywhere because of the information in it is phenomenal. Not only is it just riveting story about one of the greatest entrepreneurs, I think in the last 5 years at least, and there's, you know, we're talking about Elon Musk and, you know, some crazy entrepreneurs. Palmer Luckey, he's this guy who is, you know, was a kid and broke the code for VR and came up with Oculus.
Yeah, what were you guys doing when you were 19 years old?
Yeah, not bad.
I certainly wasn't starting a multi-billion dollar company.
Yeah. And so you started to do that story and halfway through, the election happens and Palmer is for Trump and all these things are started to be said by Facebook people and others about Palmer. You know, those things aren't true. And you start to find out that some of the people that you really had high hopes on and Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg were not what you thought. And they were actually pretty nefarious.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that in particular in two regards. One was with Palmer and the story that I was covering, you know, said Palmer posted that he would be supporting Gary Johnson in the 2016 election, which, by the way, he did end up voting for Gary Johnson, not of his own choice, but because it was suggested to him by the lawyers that because they had a trial coming up, it would be best for him to follow through with
his
statement.
You are kidding me.
Wow. I am not kidding you. So I guess it wasn't a lie that he was supporting Gary Johnson. It just wasn't his own will, since the statement had been written by Mark Zuckerberg.
And you have to tell the story about how you figured out it was not Palmer Luckey, because this is just a great piece of journalism right here.
Yeah, it really is. He wrote to me. I wrote you something, and he writes to me, and he's like, by the way, this because of the way you write your emails, this is how I figured out that Palmer had not written that. I'm like, what?
Yeah, so what that actually means is that most people, after the end of a sentence, will use one space after a period. But people who grew up with typewriters, and for some reason Palmer Luckey, used two spaces. You know, you use two spaces, and so Palmer's post in which he said he was going to be supporting Gary Johnson, which was suspicious to me anyway, because I knew we had talked so many hours about why he was supporting Trump. Palmer's post had one space, which was the first time on any of his Facebook posts over the years that he had one space. So I thought that was suspicious. I obviously didn't know at the time that the reason why was because Mark Zuckerberg wrote that and he had to post it. But that was really what set me off. So that was like my one good Sherlock Holmes moment. And I'm pretty proud of noticing that one.
Yeah. Can we be clear here, though, by the way? Two spaces is the correct way, isn't it? Is it two?
I don't know.
Yes, it
two
is.
Two spaces is right.
Yes.
That, well, and I'll also, the reason I was so aware of that was because when people leaked me emails, they oftentimes took photos of the emails and sent it to me instead of forwarding it, because I would create a paper trail. And so I would transcribe these things, and Palmer was often on the threads of when people would share stuff with me. So I was used to it. But I will also say that John Carmack, who is one of the most brilliant people in the world and who helped discover Palmer and is now at Oculus, you know, he also uses two spaces. So I will probably concede that with 2 billion people plus you guys, I'm doing it wrong. Right, but it still grinds my gears.
It's just a little tap of one finger, man. I don't know why it's such an issue.
So can you go back to the beginning of this a little bit? And because it's one thing to say it's a great entrepreneurial story of a guy in a trailer coming up with something that the best people in tech had tried to do for a while and had basically given up on at that point. How on earth does he actually do this? How does he discover how to crack this code?
Well, part of it is exactly what you've said, that most of the people had given up on it. So Palmer is a genius and a great entrepreneur and all that. But it is partly just because he was one of, let's say, less than 100 people in the world who still cared about and believed in virtual reality. And so, you know,
seems shocking. I mean, it just seems like such a straight line sort of development when it comes to the way we're immersed in everything.
And he wasn't trying to crack it because I'm going to get rich.
Right.
He really believed in it.
Well, that's really the thing that I think that you find with most successful entrepreneurs, or even the entrepreneurial side of writing, is, you know, I had 7 years as a failed screenwriter. And then when I finally wrote something the first time in my life, which was Console Wars, not for money, that was the thing that cracked, because that was passion fueled.
Right. Mm.
And Palmer, he's a gamer at heart. And so he just wanted to step into the screen and actually feel like he was in the game. So it was for his own selfish, passion filled reasons. And I was telling Glenn yesterday that the book starts in April 2012 when he starts Oculus and he connects with John Carmack, and this whole crazy ride that ends with selling to Facebook for $3 billion starts. But there's really a whole other story that is ignored by the 3 years before that of how he cracked this code and why he did it and all that. But, you know, it's not surprising in retrospect that he did, because look what he's doing now. He has a new company, Anduril, and they are coming up with great border solutions. They're in the defense business. They're trying to bring technological solutions to it. So, you know, lightning doesn't just happen to strike these people, you know, whether it's Elon Musk with Tesla and SpaceX, you know, there's something about these kinds of people, whether it's their brilliance, their ability to get other people on board. And Palmer Luckey is just one of those people that I know for the next 50 years, he's going to keep dazzling us.
It's most likely their privilege.
You know, it's true, because to me, and I think to you too, this is the ultimate rags to riches story. This kid living in a trailer. And I remember somebody once posted something like that on Reddit, and there were people who said, oh no, it's not a rags to riches story. He's, you know, white male privilege. Mm. And I'm like, he could have been anyone.
Yeah.
And when John Carmack reached out to him, which set this whole thing in motion, John was reaching out to somebody, Palmer Tech. That could have been anyone. How could any of that have to do with something with this? But
you're starting to sound like a conservative, and I won't rub that
I
in.
I apologize.
Okay. let me just talk about, we were just talking about Dave Rubin and about how he's being, shut out, and they're trying to shut him down at YouTube. Steven Crowder, the same thing is happening with him. You have had dealings with journalists in a completely different way. I mean, you're a liberal. More of a classic liberal, I would think. But you considered yourself a regular straight ahead.
Yeah, I've always voted Democrat since as far back as John Kerry.
And then you, things have kind of changed for you because you're starting to see the same thing that we even found on our side. Holy cow, some of the people on our side really suck. Right. They don't stand for what I thought we all stood for.
Right.
And can you go over some of the emails that you had?
I brought some gifts. So there's a I pulled these up because there's a great article on Niche Gamer by Sophia Narwitz, who's a games writer, and she was curious about my interactions and dealings with journalists, and to her credit was the only person who reached out to me about it, so I was happy to share my experiences. And so I pulled up some of my emails from private conversations that I had had with game and tech journalists who I considered either friends or, you know, peers, colleagues. I had a good relationship with them.
And they were asking you about, okay, come on, tell us, he's really a racist or whatever. And
right.
You were answering them honestly, and they really didn't have any intent of listening.
Right. The one that I was telling you about yesterday was I actually spent 2 hours on the phone with someone who I considered a friend. I mean, I was spending 2 hours on the phone with him. And he was asking if Palmer was a white supremacist. And I said, I can't tell you what's in his heart, but as someone who knows him probably better than anyone in the world but his girlfriend, no, absolutely no. You know, you can go back to the start of Oculus. The first three people he hired were an Asian guy, an Indian guy, and a bisexual guy. Like, you know, he just doesn't care about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of this call, the person said, well, I guess I get what you're saying, but where's the smoking gun? I want the proof that he's not a white supremacist. And I said, how can I give you the proof that he's not something that he isn't? And then here was a few responses I got while just reaching out privately to journalists after I had done this research and said,
for years.
Yeah. And said, you guys were wrong. Like, you should correct your article, or do you have any, like, or tell me your pushback for why you think I'm wrong, because I don't want to publish this book if I'm missing something.
And these articles were just to reset this part of it, because people had blamed him after he had come out and supported Trump. And it was not even in a major public way, but he had made a small donation to one political organization and had appeared at one rally where he wasn't hiding, but he wasn't like a main featured speaker or anything.
Right. The issue was largely that the organization he donated to, people would say, oh, it was not just a harmless organization. This organization, Nimble America, their plan was, their actual plan was to put up billboards across America, meme-like billboards, just like more like younger.
Funny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certainly nothing offensive about them, but people interpreted that as that they were going to put up hateful, that they had put up hateful memes across the internet.
And
first of all,
a journalism error.
Right.
Quite
they
clearly,
only put up one.
He was not.
Billboard.
Yeah. In the entire history of Nimble America, they put up one billboard ever.
And what did it say?
It said, controversially, too big to jail, and it had a picture of Hillary Clinton.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.